My Chinese portfolio has done extremely well over the last 2 months. It has gone up by anything between 50% to 70%. And I was just looking at the index. Index hasn't really done as well, but you have to isolate the non-SEO companies to non-state-owned companies to really understand what is happening in the Chinese private sector. I think the private sector companies in China have already started doing well.
Giant, how you doing?
I'm very well, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So I've been looking forward to having you on again. You're a very busy man, traveling a lot, and I'm a busy guy. So, but it just so happened I had some free time, and I thank you for your graciousness in coming on.
Well, I always have time for you, Andrew. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
You're way too kind. So the last time I had you on, I had never really experienced that kind of pushback, and I don't know what else to call it, but people were very upset. So I want to talk about that, why people are so upset at you, and what you're all about, what you're saying.
So, Andrew, it is always easy to look in your backyard and understand what's happening. In the US, the most intolerant people are the woke people. They are also the new immigrants, people who left their hellholes and now want to prove that the hellholes they left behind are somehow glorious. Now, Indians are give me a lot of pushback, and that's the reason behind it is that they claim, Hindus claim that they are the most tolerant people and that they are secular, which is completely incorrect as far as tolerances goes. But they are in a way secular because they have no moral or rational anchors. Similar to what wokes are like, and wokes are and Hindus are very similar in many, many ways. And that also makes them extraordinarily intolerant. They claim to be secular, and I have negative views of secularism because it leads to intolerance, and that's what this pushback is all about. They don't want to hear facts. They want to hear what is emotionally pleasing. They want to virtue signal rather than do good for the poor people of the society. So that's where they come from. They don't have, again, moral or rational anchors.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and not specifically to Indian people, but I would agree with you as far as wokeness, if you would. They're the most intolerant people, and they will not listen or engage on the other side, or when I say the other side, just somebody that just disagrees with them. But let's work that out, if you would, a little bit more. And I just want all the viewers to know that I track all of this, that all of the thumbs up or thumbs down and all of the comments, and overwhelmingly, so you would just so you know, there was positive feedback and positive acceptance from people from India. The way you said, the vast majority of the pushback were people from here living in North America, which I thought was quite interesting. Now, what I when I originally had you on, you had a perspective on hard assets that I found that I share with you, but also I wanted to get to know more about investing in around the world. And you are a man that's lives and travels all over the world. And where I left it with you is that you would like to, or you're very bullish on Southeast Asia and Japan, if you would, and not so much, well, not at all India. But let's really t in China, you're very bullish on China. Talk about that, and has your views changed at all on where you would put money and invest?
Let me correct a couple of things here. I am not all that bullish on Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia to me mostly means countries like Malaysia, Philippines, and and Indonesia. I'm ambivalent about them, and I do see that fanaticism is increasing in both Indonesia and particularly in Malaysia. So people who have a very glorified image of Malaysia should take a step back and get a better perspective on what's happening in Malaysia. Now, what I'm bullish on extraordinarily is East Asia, which is, which let me define what in my mind is East Asia. This is basically Chinese, Korean, and Japanese countries, which also includes Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. I just came back from a long travel assignment in China, Andrew. And I tell you, every single time I return back to China, back from China, I have a more positive view of China. Also, because when I say nice things about China, even to my good friends, they start rolling their eyes because the Western media has propagandized so much negative things to do with China that they don't want to accept anything. They want to make up stories that make them believe that going to China is very risky. I find China to be a country of rule of law. Now, again, that rule of law might not be my kind of rules, but they are still rule of law. They are not rule of man, which means that it gives a certain amount of consistency to China. I disagree with a lot of Chinese rules, and quite rightly, China is still a second world country. It's a culture that might not be what gels with me very well. That is why I live in the Western society. But at the same time, I should accept that they are different people, or I should say slightly different people, but they are doing extraordinarily well. So I'm very, very bullish on East Asia, particularly on China, because it continues to grow. And I really, really like the positive cultural changes happening in China.
You know, I had Mark Faber on about a week and a half ago, and he said really good things about, and thanks for that clarification, he said really good things about East Asia, specifically China. Does it have to deal with that the asset prices have significantly come down and are of really good value now? Is that what you see?
Well, absolutely. That is certainly one of the things. My Chinese portfolio has done extremely well over the last 2 months. It has gone up by anything between 50 to 70%. And I was just looking at the index. Index hasn't really done as well, but you have to isolate the non-SEO companies to non-state-owned companies to really understand what is happening in the Chinese private sector. I think the private sector companies in China have already started doing well. Property prices have certainly crashed. Property market is in a horrendous shape. I just drove around a lot in China recently. And, you know, you come across jungles of communities, these condo buildings, which should have maybe 30, 40, 50,000 people in them, and they are completely empty. So they do scare you. Apparently, the vacancy rate in China is anything between 10 to 20%. Now, vacancy rate in the United States would be about 3%. So yes, there's a huge amount of vacancy rate in China, but that does not mean that what you visually see is all that is there. Because I have also seen that the ghost communities do not stay ghost communities for too long. After maybe 5 years or 10 years, they start getting populated by people and things start coming together. But I think China has also learned that you cannot see that urban areas are organic systems. You can't just put them together, engineer them like a machine and imagine them to start becoming active right away. So Chinese have probably learned that lesson. So yes, property prices have fallen, but that is actually good for poor people. But also, I like the fact that the Chinese government is not interfering in the market to prop up the property market as they do in the US and in Canada. So let's give them the credit for what they deserve to get credit for, which is that they are not trying to prop up the property market, which they think should fall. And now, as a result of the fact that the property people are very scared of investing in the property market, my guess is, and I still have to understand it properly, but my guess is that more and more of this extra cash that the society is generating is going into buying other assets, which is stocks and gold and other things else than properties, because people have started to realize, at least slowly, that properties are not for investment, but for living. And that's what properties should be for, because they are a depreciating asset at the end of the day.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about China's demand for natural resources and specifically gold, because I've talked to a few different people. Just the Shanghai Gold Index now, if you wouldn't index it, Shanghai Gold Exchange now. From what I understand, that's where people or the private citizens are starting to buy gold in China, are starting to buy gold there as opposed to putting their money in property. And things like Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, I believe, are illegal. So talk to me about that. Yeah. What's your view on natural resources and gold in China?
Well, so also remember that China does have an economic problem. Young people are finding it difficult to get jobs. A lot of young people are unemployed. But this is not necessarily because the economy is in a bad shape. This has more to do with a skills mismatch. People went to the university and did something that does not provide services to the companies. So there's a mismatch of skills between what people have and what companies want. But at the same time, there is an economic problem in China. Now, in economics, when we study economics 101, we study something called overheating. But people want to ignore that concept when it comes to China. China has been growing consistently for the last three decades, more than three decades, actually. Overheating has to happen in a society like that. And despite that, China actually continues to grow and continues to grow among the fastest countries in absolute terms in the world. So yes, I know that in percentage wise, you might say that, hey, China is growing slower than, say, Rwanda. But hey, Rwanda's GDP per capita is less than $1,000. China adds more than what Rwanda's GDP per capita is on a every year basis, on per capita basis. So you know, you have to compare elephants with elephants, not elephants with mouse. So China is doing very well. I think there's a skills mismatch. There's overheating. There is an adjustment to be made. But on top of that, there is a conflict with the United States, and you can feel it. Here is the problem. American government is now making increasingly difficult for American companies to do business with Chinese companies. But they have now taken it a step further. Any company that is outside China, in which Chinese own more than a certain number of shares, is considered a Chinese company. And that also starts facing problems. So America might be creating this unnatural economic problems for China. Now, America is in the driving seat right now, but America has to understand that it might not always stay in the driving seat, and Chinese will very likely find a way around it, because they are, they are a five times the population of the US. They have a population which is more than all of the European, ethnically European societies put together. So don't assume China to be a small country. China is also militarily a very strong country now. So I think we should accept China as a competent country, and give it credit for what it deserves.
Yeah, well, talk to me then. Let's go further east then. Talk to me about Korea and Japan, two other countries that you're very optimistic about.
Again, one big thing, Andrew, is that, and this is something that you implied earlier in your introduction, and you said that Indians who are most nationalistic, who go against anything to do with India, are the Indians living in the United States. It is not the Indians living in India. So the question is that what is happening with these Indians living in the United States? Because they are not emotionally attached to the US. They are, if they have a leg in India, they're emotionally attached to India. The only reason they are likely in the US is because of money, because they make more money in the US. This multiculturalism and heterogeneity in diversity is destructive and suicidal for the US. And actually, it is taking the US down very rapidly. Culturally, the US is starting to stagnate because it has to accept multiculturalism now, given that close to 50% of Americans are now of non-European ethnicity. Now, this makes me extremely optimistic about East Asia. Koreans and Japanese continue to be homogeneous countries. Now, I was recently in Kogoshima in Japan. Now, Kogoshima is a town in the southern part of a relatively isolated part of Japan. You see a lot of Indian workers there now. So Japan is bringing in Indians to work in Japan. But remember, there's a big difference between how Japan, Korea does this thing and how the Western countries do these things. Japan and Korea follow the policy that Hong Kong and Singapore and Dubai have historically followed, which is that you might be in their countries for 1, 2, 3, 4 generations. You would still not get their passports. So, from a citizenship point of view, they continue to be homogeneous. And if as a non-citizen, if you do a crime, not only you get punished, but you get packed back home soon after your punishment is over. So there is a strong legal restraint on people from going out of their way to create a law and order situation in their countries. So that it is because of homogeneity of Korea and Japan that I'm extremely optimistic about them. People talk a lot against, the fact that they don't accept refugees. Apparently, someone was telling me yesterday that Japan accepted 303 refugees last year, whereas America accepted 100,000 refugees last year. The fact is most of those 100,000 refugees in the U.S. will end up getting citizenship of the U.S., whereas none of those 303 refugees in Japan will end up getting their passports. They will be required to go back to their home countries when the civil conflict is over. So that is the difference that makes me very optimistic about Japan. I think a lot of problems to do with Japan and Korea and China are exaggerated. Everyone who talks against East Asia, against Japan and China, is someone who has very likely never been to any of these countries. Everyone who has spent a meaningful time in these countries completely disagrees with what the Western media tells you and what the propagandized version of opinion that the vast masses of Western society has.
So if you need somebody to travel to Japan and Korea and try to let me know, I'd love to tag along with you.
Well, it is truly, Andrew, these are very easy countries to travel in. You would be surprised how easy it is. Traveling by, let's say, public transportation in China, which is what I usually do, because the public transportation is nice, competent, clean, and extraordinarily safe. And you are going to pay 2 kwai, which is about 30 cents American, to go from one part of the city to another. You have maps. You can very easily decide where you want to go to, and they are in English as well. So China has made life easy for you, people are very helpful and extremely safe. But I will keep you in mind, Andrew.
Please do. And so it reminds me, I had a talk with the great Jim Rogers, who really inspired me in my career over 30 years ago. And he would take public transportation, and he would exchange his money on the black market. And the reason he'd do that, because he didn't want to get ripped off by the state controls, if you would. But he would do that. And he'd hang out in the little countries off the beaten path. And he'd do that to really get a feel for the countries that he was visiting. And it sounds like you're cut from the same cloth, very similarly. Let's talk about your projections, not projections, but your what you're looking at, what your concerns are for starting now until the rest of the year in the investment world.
Well, the one big thing is what's happening with China right now. Certainly what China did with this shoal of Philippines, at least at surface, does not look good to me. It looks as if China has been aggressive with the Philippines. I also read some news that China went too close to the Japanese coastal border. So is China becoming aggressive? I don't know. I hope a war does not break out between China and the US. And I'm not going to take sides on this because I don't know the full details. I don't have the granular understanding of what is happening on the ground. So I'm not going to take sides on this issue. Emotionally, I'm always on the side of the US whenever there's another party involved on the other side. But, we might be provoking China into a war. We should not be agitating the US. US should not be agitating Taiwanese for freedom. It is too late now. You should have done it 30 years back. I want Taiwan to become a free country, an independent country, but US, it is too late now. You should have done it 30 years back. I hope, this is really the biggest unsolved part of the puzzle. Is there going to be a conflict between the US and China? Because that can completely change everything. My understanding from knowing Chinese, Andrew, and this is again in conflict with the perception of most people, is that Chinese go a long, long way to avoid conflicts. They are patient, they are tolerant, and if you shout at them, they want to pull back rather than fight back. This is the Chinese and the Japanese and the Korean approach. And this is very contradictory to the perception a lot of people have. China has also not been an aggressive country in the scheme of things. Look at they haven't really tried to take over borders of other countries. Look at their borders with Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia. In fact, they were very peaceful when it came to acquiring Macau and Hong Kong. So in my view, China has been a non-aggressive country. It is an inward-looking country. Historically, it has been an inward-looking country, which means that it does not want to expand its borders. It actually does not want to dilute its homogeneity by bringing in more people. So if at all, my guess is that if at all it wants to, it lays claims on some parts of India, it is more to do with humiliating Modi rather than to actually bring in Indians in as Chinese citizens. So I think people should really have a more patient understanding of what China stands for. But I really hope a war does not break out between China and the US, because the US bureaucrats certainly see China as competitors in the global theater.
Got it. So if I could paraphrase, you're really just still very optimistic and bullish on East Asia. And then the biggest thing that you're concerned about as we go into the end of the year's war. And it's interesting, war specifically with China. And it's interesting, I was just had an interview earlier today with Bob Moriarty of 321 Gold, and he didn't say the exact same as you, but sounded very similar. He is the number one story or the thing to watch for is war. And, you know, we just have to all pray that we're not going to have war. And the big wild card that he said was the war with China and Taiwan that could suck us in or will suck us in. And that is definitely a wild card. Giant, any other final thoughts before I let you go for another 3 months?
Andrew, I have some friends in the U.S. Army, and they tell me that a lot of training these days in the U.S. Army has to do with LGBTQ and woke stuff. That is actually crippling American capacity to fight a war. You really, Andrew, this is not about sexism or homophobia, but women in general don't belong to the army. On average, and a woman cannot fight with a male competition. So all this LGBTQ indoctrination is crippling the American army, but it's also crippling the American meritocracy. America has been a meritocratic country, but it is rapidly becoming a diversity, multicultural oriented country, which will basically destroyed. And I think it is now baked in the cake. In the next 10 years or so, America will fall apart because of these crazy things. And that is why I think the sane people in America should actually start shaking hands with Chinese and Japanese, because that's now where the future lies.
On that note, I was reading an article just the other day where they're actually proposing a draft and women would be drafted along with men. And I just think that's crazy. That is crazy to me. And I have three daughters, so go figure.
Well, you know, I'm sure they are very competent, physically strong women, but an average woman cannot beat an average man. It's just as simple as that. And also because of biological reasons. I mean, women go through their menstrual cycle for a few days every month. It restrains them from being able to be at the front, for example. You know, it's just not the job for women. And I think it's the right thing to do, which is to keep women away from these kind of jobs. But that does not mean you just keep them away. The competent ones can certainly come in, but it has to be based on meritocracy, which means that you should be able to fight with men as equals rather than because there's a quota allotted to women. That I'm only against quotas. I'm all for meritocracy. If a woman is strong enough and can beat me to the ground, then so it be. Bring her on.
Yeah. Got it. Well, Giant, people want to read more about you or follow you. How do they do that?
I have a website, giantpandari.com. Most things I do is go on that website.
Got it. I will put a link to that as well as your Twitter handle in the show notes below this interview. Giant, it's always a pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you. It's very stimulating, to say the least. I agree with, I catch myself agreeing with, I don't want to say everything, but it probably is everything that you said. And like I said, you'd be at the top of the list of people I'd want to travel through East Asia with. So I want to, maybe someday, our paths will cross out on the road.
Sounds great. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.